Okay, so just to say a few words about the very tricky issue of gerus for the sake of marriage, which is indeed a very thorny concept, a very challenging topic. It's clearly something that comes up a lot and that is very, very relevant to contemporary life. And actually, as we'll see, some of the halakhic details are affected by circumstances of contemporary life. So we'll look at that a little bit. As you can imagine, also, there is an extensive literature about this. I'm happy to provide you with more Marmokomos if you want to look into it in greater detail. But for starters, we just want to be aware of what some of the issues are and to be appreciative of what the considerations might be. And also to start off with a reiteration of what we saw yesterday, when we discussed the attitude of Hillel and the Tosfos and the Beis Yosef and the Shach, who also emphasizes this, that ultimately a lot is in the hands of the discretion and the judgment of the Dayanim. That these circumstances are very variable, very much affected by a lot of other aspects that are part of the picture, and there's a lot of judgment that goes into it. And not every question is yes or no. Sometimes it involves saying, okay, we have to make this a longer process. Sometimes there has to be a shorter process. Sometimes there has to be other aspects brought into the conversation. So in real life, there's a lot true about almost everything, and almost everything we'll talk about in terms of gerus, but there's an added level of truth in this case, that there's an added level of reality, that there are many, many subjective factors and many points which the Dayanim and the rabbis involved are going to have to be very appreciative of and be able to sensitively address as far as what that situation requires. So with that introduction, to look at what some of the issues are, so we saw that from, I keep saying our Gemara because we don't have a Masechta here, but to treat home base for Geirus as the middle of Yuzamos over there, the Menzav, Menzayin, that area where many of the halachos are, even though we've seen them scattered in other places, to say that from that Gemara where these fundamental principles exist. So we saw that we're trying to ascertain that the gerus is motivated for the right reasons. Right reasons being an actual interest in connecting to the Jewish people and the values and rules of the Jewish people and God's mission. That we're concerned about motivation. And we're also concerned that the individual be ready to commit to the program fully. And that's something which we'll also explore in much greater detail when we talk about the process of gerus and the role that Kabbalas HaMitzvos has in that process. So some of that we'll get into more in that context, but just to discuss it now, only to the limited extent that we need to appreciate for this part of the question. So if somebody were to come to convert with a, let's just put it mildly, with a strong interest in a spouse, a potential specific Jewish person of the opposite gender, and however you want to define the interest, whatever degree of interest has been expressed until now, so we have a concern from both directions. We have a concern that that's an ulterior motive. They're not necessarily interested in the Judaism. They're interested in the person. And we also have a concern, which is a much more significant concern halachically, that there isn't going to be an actual commitment to gerus. And to whatever extent there needs to be a acceptance of halacha and mitzvot, that that's not going to actually be there because the person is not coming for that the person is coming to get married. So that is the much more significant problem. They're both issues, but the second problem is a bigger one. And that's something that we'll see also. So in addition to our Gemara and the Mems and Yevamos, so the source that is relevant here is the Gemara earlier, the second parak, and of Chof Dalet Amid Beis, which I assume you got a chance to see. So there the Gemara has what seems to be a machlokas with Nehemiah and Rabbanan, although it may not be as much of a machlokas as it sounds like. But the Mishnah over there, got a chance to see it, the Mishnah says that if someone is suspected of a relationship with a shifcha, that's one of the contexts of the Mishnah, or he's suspected of a relationship with a non-Jewish woman, so then he shouldn't marry this woman even after she converts. So that's itself an issue we have to figure out. That's the din of nitan, a nitan al shivcha, nitan al agaya. So that halacha set aside for a minute, although it's important. But the Gemara picks up on that and says, oh, it's okay, so we have this side concern, but it sounds like still the conversion takes effect. And it sounds like here you have a man who has a suspected relationship with a non-Jewish woman, and we're telling him not to marry her after she converts. But it sounds like if she converts, she's a convert. It sounds like she is Jewish. So the Gemara asks, didn't we learn that that's not effective? That if somebody converts for an ulterior motive, that's a problem? And the Gemara quotes Reb Nechemia as part of this objection. But then the conclusion is, in the view of Rabbanan, that kulam geirim hain, that they are considered to be geirim. They are considered to be effectively converted. So, first of all, what this back and forth highlights is the structure of the two issues we were just talking about and the relative importance. Because, as we were explaining, there is a lechatchila and there is a b'dieved here. That lechatchila, we try to make sure that all the motivations are ideal and all the commitments are ideal. And that's our ideal approach, which doesn't necessarily mean that if we don't do that process or if that process is unsatisfactory, that the geiris is not effective. So that's a part of the dynamic that you see in that Gemara, that the Gemara is reflecting that, saying that we do our best to make sure we have ideal geirim, but even failing that, the geiris might still be effective, which seems to be the bottom line. But, as we highlighted a few minutes ago, there are two issues, and they're not equally important. So one issue is making sure the motivation is pure. That is more of a chatila. But that the actual commitment should be real. It should actually be taking on Judaism and its rules and regulations and values. That's a bigger problem. It's a problem that could be ma'akid. So that's where that issue becomes thornier. So here, the Ritzva, if you had a chance to see, so the Ritzva comments on the position of Rabbanan that Kulam Geirim Haim, says the Ritzva, why is that? Because, yes, what brought them in was something that's not focused on Torah specifically, but Lamaisa, they're going to have to live a Jewish life if they want to marry this person. So they're going to have to follow through with all the rules. They're going to have to take on halachic practice. So, okay, what brought them through the door was not actual religious zeal, but at the end of the day, this is what they're going to have to take on. So if that's the case, that's why it's valid. That's how the Ritva assumes, what it sounds like also from the Rambam. Hi, Shlomo.
Hey, good morning. So the Ritva, when I read it, seemed to say, I might have been interpreting wrong, but it seems to say that we keep her in like this, what we call limbo state,
mm-hmm.
until we know if she converted for the right reason. Is that like a valid interpretation of the Ritva? Or is it more of like they are okay, but we just check it?
So that's a major discussion, and that is not just from the Ritva, but from other sources also, right, like the Rambam and others. And we'll discuss that. We may have to discuss a little bit separately, but just to speak about it for a second. So this idea of Adshe Yivaris Titkuso, and that we should, until we see my Acharisman, you find the language a little bit different in different sources, but we kind of hold it in abeyance to see exactly how righteous they end up being. So it's not clear what that means. Does that mean that they're a Sufik Jew? They're not. So here the poskim struggle with that because it doesn't seem like that's really practical. And there are various distinctions that are drawn, but I want to get into that in more detail, so I don't want to shortchange the discussion. But it might mean, for example, just a question of how actively embracing are we. So we kind of wait to see what's going to turn out, and then we'll be more welcoming, but the mice of the gayrus is there, or does it mean that we're just looking to see if there's a reversal of the whole commitment, and that there's blatant non-religious practice? It's a tricky point, so we have to figure out exactly what that means. Practically, it's not 100% clear and content and unanimous as to what it's going to mean, practically speaking.
Rabbi Shira, and he's on the Avodah Din Queens,
uh-huh.
He has like a conversion. So what he told us that he does for any convert that comes is that, you know, they finish the whole process, but he doesn't give them like a certificate of conversion for a full year afterwards. So he kind of waits for them to receive that. So I don't know if that's, I assume most Avodah Din don't do that, but I think that that could be a way that we could be to kind of fix this problem to see if they're just converting for, you know, an ulterior motive or not.
So that could be that, but you do that, does that for every gay or just in certain circumstances?
From what I understood from him, he does it from like every gay that comes. I mean, maybe someone who was going to Jewish school their whole life might be different,
right.
But it seems to be that, especially for like new gay that come, he wants to make sure that they're actually committed to, like the point that we've been talking about.
It's interesting because from these sources, talking about specifically somebody who has given us reason to question their motivation. But, so that may be an additional element. Hi, fine. You're on, I say.
Talking to Ritva, Agav Unzayo,
yeah.
One of them is his own age. They says that we have a Chazaka.
So on the surface, the onus is that he wants to marry this woman or she wants to marry this man, and this is what they need to do in order to get what they're so focused on. So, okay, and they'll take on the whole package. So they didn't get through the door in a totally pure way, but at the end of the day, it's going to be the commitment we're looking for. So, therefore, it sounds like from the Ritva, that's the reason why we accept it. Now, what exactly does that mean? And is that a absolute kind of yes or no question? That's what we'll see in a second, the subject to a lot of analysis. But very broadly, it means that, okay, they want to marry this person. They can't do that without taking on their religion and the whole package. And therefore, that's what they're going to do. But we'll see in a second that the details are subject to a big debate. Tyler?
Yeah, just in the Mishnah of the Rambam, he says that they're always going to be a Jew no matter what. Once they're accepted once, then that's it, game over. You can't go back on being non-Jewish. So wouldn't that go against what you mentioned a moment ago?
Yeah, exactly. That's a part of the tension, which is also I want to come back to. I can tell you some of the Lumdish approaches to that. But that issue is exactly what creates some confusion, because it sounds like once they're converted for sure, and then even if we see the most blatant averus, even if we see them engaged in idolatry, then we still, they're like a Jew who committed idolatry. It doesn't get undone. So So that's exactly the problem, is that how is that square with this idea of kind of holding it in limbo and seeing what happens? So that's part of what the Achronim struggle with. For example, I can give you some sources that talk about the lumdus of it, but it prompts the question that it doesn't seem like that has as much practical relevance as it sounds, for exactly that point, that if we see that somebody who's converted later on is doing the worst averos, they're still Jewish, so then what would it mean to say we're kind of holding it off to see how it happens? One thing that we'll see, and trying to go in order, so not doing it in full detail now, but when the question is going to come up of, is there retroactive nullification of the geiris or not? So it's very, very subtle, and this is a topic of huge controversy in practice, huge, because theoretically, once somebody becomes Jewish, so then that should be irrevocable. The issue is, was the process flawed to begin with? So figuring out whether it's one or the other. If you had a good process and then this person becomes a total Avarian, okay, so then they're still Jewish and they're a Jew who's sinning, which is what the Gemara was saying. We say to them, listen, you know, if you sin, you're going to be responsible for it. But at the same time, seeing some sources that indicate slightly differently, it's a very subtle distinction. It means that if the whole process was never sincere, and we figure that out based on what we see later, that they never meant it in the first place, so then that theoretically could tell us that it was never a real gate. So clearly it's a very subtle distinction. And as you can imagine, this is the subject of massive controversy in practice. And if you know some of the history of modern Israel and some of what's happened in the past few decades, some huge, huge fights over the subtleties of this issue. Philip, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering, going back to the machloket or the outlook of Shammai versus Hillel in terms of accepting someone who wants to be a Kohen Gadol, you said before that that was mainly potentially referencing the acceptance of the welcoming of potential Gerim. But could that, I guess, difference in Aleph also represent the practical, halot of Geirus, meaning Hillel, even though your intentions aren't so great, he would still accept you because you're going to be Mekabel. And so it's in the end of the day. But Beit Shammai, the fact that your, let's say, intentions weren't so good, so to speak, then maybe the Geirus wouldn't even be Hal.
Yeah, so that's the question, and that's why it's hard to give an absolute answer because there are some subtleties in interpretation. So, for example, what do we have as far as the sources? So the Gemara just tells us Hillel accepted them, and Tosfos says it's because he knew that they would be Lishma. And the Beis Yosef and the Shas, these are very authoritative sources, telling us that, okay, you see, it's up to the Dayan to decide what is proper path here. So you could say it means that he accepted them and understood that he converted them and understood that it would be effective. Then the Marsha kind of changes the time frame by saying that he didn't convert them on the spot. He took them into his program and accepted them as people who were training and understood that they would need more training first. But also, that's an important distinction between the two, but they both still don't necessarily affect the question of whether it's chal or not. So it sounds like even bad motivations don't necessarily affect the chalos. It's a question of a bad commitment can affect the chalos. And motivation connects to commitment. Because if your motivation is coming from somewhere else, so then that's the reason for you not to be sincere in the commitment. So they're two separate questions, but they're connected. And that's a part of why this is so subjective and subtle, and why it's a huge, huge fight. And again, this is a fight that flared up in Eretz Yisrael about 10 years ago, flared up very strongly, and it was a major, major fight a few decades before that with a very prominent story that was a major turning point in modern rabbinic history in Israel. So it's the subtleties of this issue are very, very significant. Hi, Moshe.
Does this purposely sound a lot like Kiddushei Tos? Like, if the man figures out something, you know, that the whole Kedushin was off, and
mm-hmm.
maybe because it's like a marriage between person and Hashem, so if there's something that, you know, we would have known before that wasn't revealed, then we could say the whole process was flawed, and then they weren't really converted.
Well, it does overlap, probably for slightly different reasons, but it does overlap because it is about whether something was happening under accurate premises or not. So to that extent, they are related, that the assumption that a marriage is only valid because both parties know what they're getting into, and that this is only valid because the facts are being accurately represented. And that question maybe become clear in the next few minutes, some of the elements that are relevant to assessing it. So just to throw some more information onto the table, you see some of the complexities of this. So if one follows the Ritva, and the way it sounds like from some other Rishonim also, that the reason that they're Geirim is because ultimately the commitment will be there. So is that objectively true? Is it true all the time? And pointedly, is it still true, let's say, in the 20th century and the 21st century? So the reason I'm saying 20th century is because there was an objection that was raised already in the previous century. I mentioned Dvar Avram, I think, the other day, the Kavna Rav. So Dvar Avram has a tshuva where he says, nowadays things are different. That when it comes to contemporary society in his day, a few decades ago, 100 years ago, so it was no longer true what was the premise in the time of Chazal. So back then, okay, if you wanted to get married to a Jewish person, you're going to have to take on Jewish life. But it's not true anymore. Right? We see that people can live a non-religious life also. And that the people who are already involved with non-Jewish relationships maybe are less inclined to be carrying out halakhic practice to begin with. And this is an assumption, not necessarily the whole story, but that therefore it's not necessarily the case that by marrying this Jewish person, the individual is going to be entering into a observant lifestyle or the other trappings of a Jewish commitment. And therefore, argues the Dvar Avram and a number of others, this is no longer true, that the assumption that Kulam Geirim, which the Ritva explains, is based on that ultimate acceptance is not necessarily there. So therefore, as a matter of practicality, this has shifted. Now, others disagreed, and there's a lot of nuance here, as you can see, and clearly it's going to vary from person to person. Right? You know, so you have to assume that the Dvar Avram would agree that, okay, maybe it's no longer a given that everyone marrying a Jewish spouse has to take on the Jewish lifestyle, but there clearly are many people throughout all times of history who do. So that should still be true in their case. Or that gets a little bit into the Ad She Yisbara Tzidkuso element, that once you can figure out that that's the case, it should be true. But just speaking broadly, as he does, so there are others who took the opposite approach, such as Ravaji Yosef, and there was a few articles about this. There's a journal called Tarsh Valpeh, which records the proceedings of conferences on various topics. And in one of the journals, one of the editions, one of the editions of Tarash Malpeh, there are a few articles about this. There's an article by Rav Zsolti, Sefer Mishnas Yavetz, where he takes a position like the Dvar Avram, that nowadays we have to be more skeptical about this. And Rav Adja took the opposite position. Rav Adja said that, no, you could say totally differently. And you could say that nowadays something else changed. You know, it's not just the question of whether religious observance has changed. That once upon a time, everyone had to observe halacha if they were part of the Jewish community, and not anymore. But there's something else that changed in the opposite direction. That if they want to be with this person, they don't really need to be Jewish anymore. That the acceptance of intermarriage and the acceptance of being together before marriage has shifted, so they don't have a pressure to convert in the first place. You see, it's a shift in the other direction. That the original assumption was, if you want to be with this person, you're going to have to A, convert, and B, live a fully observant life. But Dvar Avraham is saying the last part of that change. You don't have to live an observant life anymore, so it all falls apart. So Ravaja is focusing on you don't have to convert. And maybe you don't even have to get married. And therefore, if one is choosing to convert to for their spouse, it's not a pressure that they have to give into unless they want to. You know, just as a different area of halacha, but just as an example of how some of these things shift. Remember, as once discussing was by Willigan, there's a discussion in Poskim that if you're a Masada Kedushin and you are dealing with a couple that's not going to observe Taras Mishpacha, they're not going to observe Hilchos Nida. So there's a discussion in the postgame about whether there's a problem in being Masada Kedushin for that. Is that an issue of Lufnei Iver? Should you not facilitate this marriage? Disgusting. I think it was discussed with Vailog once. I didn't understand the whole discussion, that it's explicit in the sources that the Isra Nida applies whether a couple is married or not married. So by helping to give them a kosher Kedushin, you're not making the Isra Nida any worse. So as you pointed out, it's just my more modern ears was needed a reminder that no, once upon a time, the couple is not going to be together at all unless you provide them with a wedding. So you're going to really affect whether they're going to violate the Isra Nida. Nowadays, the assumption is that they have the ability to be together one way or another. So the fact that you're adding a kosher Kedushin to their lives is only an improvement. But once upon a time, you might have been stopping them from violating the Isra Nida if you weren't going to officiate at their wedding. So that's something that has changed culturally, and it affects these halachic components. So Rabbi Vajra, his point is relevant to that also, but it's a twofold point. So basically three cultural changes. You have to be religious and halachically observant. You have to be halachically practicing in order to be a part of the Jewish community. Do you need to convert to Judaism to marry a Jewish person? And you need to get married to be with that person. So all three of those social questions are relevant, and they impact on different decisions. What kind of pressure is on the person when they make these considerations? Somebody had a question?
Yes, it's kind of an application problem for everything that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ask someone, like one of the big questions in Israel today is about the army conversions, right?
Yeah.
Whether or not that they're valid conversions, and I guess it ends up being basically a case-by-case type situation. So my question is, if someone had an army conversion and then they asked you as a rabbi to do their wedding for them, and you know for a fact that they're not keeping, you know, Shabbat or not doing any of those types of things, even though they learned about it all before the army conversion, is that something that you would facilitate as a rabbi?
That's a great question, and I'm going to punt right now, not because it's a tricky question.
I don't know if it's so relevant.
No, it is. It's extremely relevant. You know, it's a part of what you need to figure out, but I'm going to hold off until we discuss Kabbalah Samitzos, because that's a whole separate discussion. We need to know about it now because it also affects this question of accepting. But as far as the practicalities, we'll be more equipped to discuss it when we fully understand what Kabbalah Samitzos motion.
Yeah, I just have a question for Avram.
Yeah.
So when he makes his comment, he's assuming that the Rabbanan in the Gemara, like the Rishpa, that they're, ultimately they're going to be accepted, that this Hakana, if he's going to say that it's not applicable, doesn't this get into the concept of like the Sugya Tana Mesos, Tandu, like do this Hakana of Chazal still apply even though we don't necessarily see it? I remember somebody mentioned, Rabbi Simon mentioned that the Rav had an opinion about that.
Another big controversy.
History, so.
Yeah, so many big controversies.
Right.
So basically,
the Rav Raman implying that if the Ritz is correct, that the Rabbanim's reason for them being Gerim is because they're no longer going to be, they're going to be observant ultimately. So keep saying that's not true anymore. Is this relevant to that Machloka?
So just to address it very broadly, because I'm not sure if everyone knows what you're referring to, but I'll just address it. Basically a threefold response. That Rav Soloveitchik was involved in a very public refutation of a suggestion that certain attitudes in halacha should change because there it has to do with marriage, in this case, that the Gemara has a statement, Tav Lametav Tendum Lametav Amalo, that assumes that a woman would rather be married than be single, and therefore would rather be married to a person no matter what their flaws than to be alone. And the argument was made that, no, it's not true anymore. And society has changed, and it's not true anymore, and therefore that shouldn't impact our halakhic decision. And Rav Soloveitchik was very strongly, very, very strongly opposed to this, and gave a very fiery speech, where he essentially says that when the Gemara says this principle, it is an axiomatic truth of history, that it's a reality that the halakha reflects, and it's not something that is subject to change. So Moshe's question is, should we say that that's essentially true here also? So the short answer I would give is that probably not as much as it sounds like, even though there's a superficial connection. But say, first of all, you have to figure out how far the Rav would have gone with that. Was he saying that by every such chazaka? So if a chazaka represents what people generally do or what people generally think, then maybe that is subject to change. And that's actually a whole sugya of chazaka asuye lishtanos, and other chazakos that may reflect cultural patterns that may change. In this case, the Rav emphasized that it's based on a pasuk in Bereishis, ve'lishech l'shukachech, that there is a inherent reality that is embedded in human nature, and that the pasuk reflects that, and it's not clear he would have said that by every such chazaka. So there are issues that are requiring of further clarification as far as that's concerned. Here also, it's more open to debate because the Gemara doesn't say this. The Gemara just says, Kulam Geirim. And the Ritz explains, oh, Kulam Geirim, because of an assumption. But maybe that assumption, he's arguing, is culturally dependent. The Dvar Ram is saying within the Ritz is culturally dependent. So that itself is going to leave us more room to say that maybe it's going to be different. So in any event, so there is extensive debate about this, and like we can imagine, it impacts practicality a lot. And one of the other issues that is also brought into the mix, and it goes to Moshe's previous question about the mekachtos and the like. So one question is, if somebody is makabel the mitzvos, and somebody says that they are committed to the whole program, so keep in mind, like we said, that if somebody successfully converts, then the averus they do later don't matter. They matter as far as spiritual status, but they don't undo the gears. The question is, if it retroactively shows us that they never were serious in the first place. That's the core issue, right? So one could ask, what about the principle that we find in the Gemara, that Dvarim Shebelev Einam Dvarim? Right? That's not a statement against Neo-Hasidus. It means that Dvarim Shebelev means things that are unspoken, which may contradict things that are spoken. So let's say if I make a business transaction with somebody and I say, okay, these are the terms, but in my mind I'm really thinking different terms. So to that, the Gemara says, doesn't matter what you're thinking or what's in your heart, it matters what was actually articulated. So whatever the terms are that we said, that's what's going to be binding. And I don't have the right to say, well, I was thinking something else, and that's going to define our circumstances. We say, Dvarim Shebelev Einam Dvarim. We don't go based on what you might be thinking. We go based on what was spoken. So how much does that play a role here? That if somebody comes and says, I am Mekabel Geiris, and I'm Mekabel Mitzvos, I take on the whole commitment to the religion, so why should we be saying, well, we got to figure out what he really means? Right, why don't we say, Dvarim Shubalei Venam Dvarim, whatever he says, that's it. So if you accepted it, you accepted it. Right, especially since we see that breaking the acceptance doesn't undo it. Right? So we see that the fact that he might be doing Averos later doesn't let him out of it. And that if somebody actually converted and ends up later on abandoning Halacha, in whole or in part, he's still Jewish. So then, let's say that's the whole story. That if he accepted the mitzvos, he said, I accept it, so then that's what it is. And doesn't matter what happens afterwards, as far as the kashrus of the geiris is concerned. So that's a question that some ask. Why don't we say here, Dvarim Shubalei Veinam Dvar? So there are a number of responses to that. Some say that geiris is different because the whole idea of the Kabbalah is the internal commitment. It is a internal reality. If I make a transaction with you, so whatever the terms are going to affect you and affect me. So it's only fair that we have to stick with what's written or what's spoken. And we can't say, well, you made this deal, but you were thinking something else, and therefore it shouldn't be chal. It's not fair to the other party. And for example, there's a discussion in Poskim that when a store sells its chametz, it's a controversial topic. So let's say the store sells its chametz to a non-Jew, but continues to operate over the course of Pesach. So maybe that shows that he never really meant to sell it. How is he continuing to do business with chametz that he sold to someone else? So doesn't that show that it wasn't a genuine sale? So many poskim are very bothered by that. But others will respond that it doesn't matter that he shows later that he never meant it. It's not up to him not to mean it. If you made a sale to somebody else and you said, okay, you gave me money, I'm giving you this, and then later on I show that I never meant it, but that's not fair to you. You purchased it, you paid for it, so you have the right to assume it's yours. And we can only go based on what's overt and what's spoken. I don't have the right to deprive you of the purchase that you paid for because of my later behavior, which shows that I wasn't sincere. So that's true if you're dealing with a transaction between two people. But the question is, should geiris be viewed that way? Maybe geiris is simply about the individual, how he fully encounters Judaism, and if he didn't really mean it, then he's the one who pays the price for not really meaning it. He's the one who... Now, clearly, practically, that's not true, because practically, he's affecting many people around him, especially when there's a marriage context. But still, maybe geiris is different than a business transaction, and it's not about a requirement that everything be clear to both parties, because really, it's about the individual themselves. That's one question. But an additional element that a number of posts can bring up, Moshe Feinstein, and Zvi Avraham talks about this also in his objection here, that even though we normally say, Dvarim Shebelei Veinam Dvarim, that's true in general circumstances. But if there's an Anan Sadi the other way, if the reality is so clearly different, if everyone can testify just by knowing what's around them, that this isn't the fact, so then that is going to be valid. It's not just Dvarim Shebelei. So the argument would be here that if you have a couple that's getting married and everyone knows there's no chance in the world they're living any kind of religious life, so that's not an issue just of Dvarim Shebelei. It's not that, well, he said one thing, but we have to do mind reading to figure out that he means something else. We don't have to read his mind. Everyone can see. Everyone knows what kind of life they're living. And therefore, that's an Anan Sadi that is going to outweigh whatever spoken words that they express. So that's an attitude a number of posts can have, that when it's overwhelmingly clear that there was never a sincere Kabbalah Samitzvah, so then that's going to undermine it, even separate from any concerns of Dvarim Shebaleit. Shlomo?
Based on that, I mean, it comes down to, I guess, what do we define also as religious life? Like,
absolutely.
If they're going to keep Shabbat and Kashrut, but
mm-hmm.
not Nidahs, is that
right.
work? Is it not work? So, I don't know if we're going to discuss that now. Maybe
right.
not.
No, obviously, we'll get to that more in the Kabbalah Samitzvah part, but you're definitely right that certainly there's so much subjectivity here that there is a lot that goes into the question of what is perceived as being a major part of the religion, because of some of the poskim write that Ein Tzadik La'aretz Asher Ya'aseh Tov V'lo Ya'aseh. So what do you mean? You mean that Kabbalah Samitzvos has to require that you will never miss anything, that you'll never do any Avera? So presumably we have to distinguish between what's actually what's technically an Avera, and what is defined as the basic baseline practice of observant Jews. And we'll have to distinguish between different Averos, which probably is not going to be a function of severity in the Chiyuv Misa or Chiyuv Karis or the Rabbana Deraisa, as much as what is identified as the practice of observant Jews and what isn't. And that could very much be culturally dependent, and what might be true in one place may not be true in a different place. And just one more level of the subjectivity and the discretion here, but a fuller discussion of that we'll have in the context of the Kabbalah Samitzvot. But you're right, that's certainly...
But are we allowed to say that, like, halacha is based on culture then? I thought halacha is supposed to be, you know, kind of like the bottom line, and we build culture off of halacha, basically.
Well, we build our ideal culture after halacha,
meaning,
but the
yeah,
realities yeah. of society very much affect what halacha is always going to be affected by the reality in front of you, whether it's chemistry or sociology or physics or anything else. So we have to know the facts in order to know the application. As Rosh Hashanah always points out, we say the halacha changes or not. So the halacha is always the same. The question is, what sif of Shulchan Aruch are you applying? So every sif of Shulchan Aruch is going to say, okay, in this case, these are the rules, and in that case, those are the rules. So the question is, what's the case? And it goes also to Moshe's previous question that some statements may reflect something more eternal, and some may reflect something that is a read of society, and there are different sources for each case. Hi, Phil.
Could this be connected to our question of who performs the gerus? Meaning, if it's the ger himself, then it should be internal. But if it's based in, then potentially it's like a transaction, or based in can only work with the assumptions that's spoken, and then that would you know, shift in the other direction.
So it does seem to be dependent on that to some extent. That's also a subtle question, because we find some of the other discussions, and we'll see this when we talk about the role of Beis Din, that yes, that's the question, though, is Beis Din actually doing the gerus? Or is the ger doing the gerus? But the halacha is that he has to do it in front of Beis Din. So it would seem like that's relevant to that question. But there too, there are subtleties. We got to figure out just how much of a difference it makes. So, for example, yesterday we talked about Rosh Weiss's tshuva about pushing off for side reasons. So he starts off saying that it seems to be related to that also. Is the Beis Din just there as a formality? Or is the Beis Din actually doing the gerus, which should give them more of a role in evaluating? But even within the first possibility, no, it's clear that they're not robots. You know, it's clear that they have some evaluation and decision-making role here. And therefore, the difference isn't going to be that wide as far as practicality, because clearly they still have to bring their input and their understanding of the situation according to both understandings. So that's as far as this concern of contemporary marriage is very much affected by a lot of nuances. But just to reiterate the important point, there's two considerations, and one is very significantly different than the other, even though they impact. So one consideration is motivation. We want a pure motivation. That's more of a l'chafila. And that if we don't have pure motivation, it seems like, at least on some level, the person is converted anyway, even though we may not call that person a ger tzedek, and maybe there are differences between a ger and a ger tzedek. But at the end of the day, it seems like improper motivation is not going to be a disqualification. But the much more serious consideration is the commitment. Is the commitment genuine? And that's where there are a lot of different elements. And the issue of marriage is that it affects both. Marriage is a size motivation, which is a problem but not a fatal problem, but a incomplete commitment is a bigger issue, and there's a flow from one to the other, but they're very different issues. The Mordechai commenting on that Mishnah and that Sugya on Daf Kodalad and Mubez, he understands, for example, that the assumption that there's two different opinions, Rav Nechemia who says they're not Gerim and Rabbanan who say they are Gerim, it's not necessarily the way, it's not necessarily such a machlokas. That Rav Nechemia was assuming that they, when he said they're not Gerim, was assuming that they're only motivated by ulterior motives. They have no interest in Judaism itself. But if there's both, if they're influenced by the desire to get married, that's what brought them into the equation, but they're also willing to accept Judaism too, maybe Rav Nechemia would also agree that that's a effective gerus. So that's also part of the nuances here. So there's a lot of variability, and as many point out, that if there is a combination of motives or a suffix of motives, so that all pushes things more into the acceptability area, that when we focus on motives, it's probably more when it's exclusively a clear ulterior motive. But when it's not exclusively or not so clear, that's where we get more into the twilight zone. Like, for example, the Gemara also says that it's a chiddush, you need to be told from a pasuk that we're makabel gerim in Eretz Yisrael. Why? What's the chiddush? Why shouldn't you? So the Gemara proves both. So we're makabel gerim outside of Eretz Yisrael and makabel gerim in Eretz Yisrael. So each one has some chiddush to it, and the idea, why would you need to be told that you're makabel gerim in Eretz Yisrael? Because you might think that it's just because of all the good things associated with being a Jew in Israel that that's why they want to convert. And we see, no, that that's not the assumption, and that they can convert anyway. The Tartamima has a comment over there, and other stands also. They mean that, okay, that if there's just a possibility of some other motive that's mixed in, that's not enough of a reason to say that this shouldn't be an acceptable gerus. So these two different levels of problems are very much a part of it. And the subtleties and the variabilities are extreme. And what we saw also, that some of the cultural factors that affect it revolve around this position of the Ritva, and maybe it's the position of other Rishonim as well, that the second more important issue of a commitment to the religion, so that is what we are assuming will happen because of the desire to be in the marriage, and therefore, at the end of the day, that's what makes the work. And we saw that the Achronim argued from one extreme to the next how much that is still true, and we highlighted at least three possible cultural changes that may affect it in various directions. The question of, is it still true that to marry a Jewish person you need to accept the halachic lifestyle? Second question, is it still true that to marry a Jewish person you need to convert to Judaism? And is it still true that to be with a non-Jewish person you need to marry them? So those three questions are practical issues, practical realities of the current society that all could impact in conflicting directions. And then we also got into the question of, okay, but maybe the person accepts the Judaism and its requirements, that's all that matters, because Tvarim Shebelei Veinam Tvarim. So whatever you say, that's all that should matter, especially because the enormous subtlety of the difference between somebody who converts and then abandons religion, where we say they're still Jewish, and somebody whose abandonment of religion is supposed to reflect that they never meant it in the first place. So we'll say, okay, but if you said it, that's all that matters. And we saw why that wasn't necessarily the position of all poskim, because potentially maybe this is different than a transaction, Dvarim Shebelev are more important, or as other poskim emphasized, that Dvarim Shebelev we're not necessarily going to look to, but an Anan Tzadi will look to, that if everyone can see what kind of a lifestyle there is, was never a pretense of religious practice, and everyone knows that, so then that does count. It's not Dvarim Shebelev. That's something that is evident to people who are aware, and that would outweigh whatever is being spoken. Just to, you know, for clarity, I want to plug that in to the Chametz on Pesach with the Storitz case. It's those possibilities. So he said that the fact that some postman will say the fact that the store continues to do business shouldn't negate the sale that they made of their chametz, because the purchaser has the right to assume that I can go based on what's being spoken and what's being written. So you signed a contract with me saying you're selling me the chametz. The fact that you behave in a way that, or that you have intent, that your dvarim shebelev were not sincere, shouldn't undermine that. But others will respond, what do you mean, Dvarim Shebelev? Everyone knows the store is open. He's been doing this for years. He keeps the store is publicly open over the course of Pesach. That's not just Dvarim Shebelev. Everyone can see that that's the reality. So the purchaser also should know that they're clearly not actually giving him the chametz, and it's not, it was never a serious kind of transaction. So that's a part of the whole dynamic there, that sometimes there are other elements that enter into the understanding, and that's also a part of it. So those are some of the major issues. What you came away with here is a big suffix, but that's what you're supposed to come away with. And I said if you get involved in the situation, so you will try to factor in all of the different questions and make sure you have the best guidance possible. What we still didn't fully address is the additional issue of nitan, which could complicate things. So if you have somebody that's coming in a previous relationship, and now asking to convert. So, okay, let's say the conversion is good. Like the Gemara over there says, let's assume that the conversion is acceptable. But should that be a problem now for that couple to get married? Because what about this halacha of nitan? So is that something that's going to get in the way? So that we should still say a few more words about. So maybe we'll add a little bit about that on Monday. And maybe also say another word or two about this question about Shiyasbar Tzikuso, what that means practically, and then start off with the topic of the actual process of the Geiris, Mila, and Tfila, the Kabbalah Samitzis, and Bezdin, a lot of major sugyas to address as far as all those questions are concerned. So, God willing, that's on our agenda for Monday. I wish you a safe and healthy and meaningful and productive Tainus. We should be able to restore the Avas Chinam and the Kavod Abrios that we need in order to undo this Galus. And we should soon find ourselves redeemed from all of our suffering and from our more localized contemporary Galus and from the longer-term Galus that we've been struggling with for so torturous a period. Okay, we'll see you soon. And have a good Shabbos also. Kol Tov.
Thank you.
Thank you.